Accession number 18730, Reel 2.
Jim Cox, Reel 2.
The sergeant stating, like, that when we're on exercises and we had our Tommy Cookers with us and individual rations to cater for ourselves, he said, I had mine cooked and eaten before the others got theirs unwrapped, so I was obviously a likely fella to make tea. Well, to make tea for 72 people, you had to start at the basics, so we got the tea buckets and measured 72 mugs of water in to start with, and then pouring them into dixies and eating them up. And you had to do the same with the tea. Well, generally a pint of tea could be made drinkable with one teaspoonful of tea, so we did the same 72 again. And we got through that all right. There were bread, and there was bread and margarine in the store. So we cut up a hunk of bread, I did, and margarine, a touch, and so then they were telephoning all over, but they could not find a cook. So he said, well, do you think you could do breakfast? Well, I said, yes, I can do the breakfast, because there was the bacon all sliced, rashers, and so I said, I want some help, though. So I had a mate come in with me. And I said, you slice 72 slices of bread, about an inch thick. And I lay the bacon out. And we had the sentries keep the fire going all night, so we had no trouble in the morning. And anyway, I got this job. Believe it or not, they'd even ordered a swill man to come and fetch the swill, but no cook. So, and next day they couldn't find a cook, so and I had that job for 3 weeks before, of course, eventually two cooks arrived, didn't they? But my butchering training, you see, of years gone by, stood me in good stead there, because all the meat the army issued, I could make the best of it. And they sent a whole gammon down one day, which should have been sliced up for frying for breakfast. I said that was a shame. I boiled it in one piece, and they had boiled ham for tea. And the officer sent down his congratulations, said he'd never enjoyed that in the officer's mess since he joined the army. So I didn't know how I did it, but I made soup, and they had at least a mug of soup for supper every night. At a weekend, I had perhaps a tin or two of bully, a little packet of sugar each. There was generally six or eight chaps going on weekend leave, so I always had a little titbit which they thought, first in, first served, the families would like, the mothers would like when they got home. And tin of bully, bit of sugar, few currants, anything. But at the end of 3 weeks, oh, the swill man refused to come after a week. He said he got nothing but bleached bones and potato peelings. So I made soup of everything. But the cooks, these cooks had been there about 3 days when they had a messing meeting, which you can voice your own opinion at a mess meeting in the army. And the one and only thing they asked for at this messing meeting was, can cooks do the cooking again? They didn't like the army cooks, they liked my man better. But we, in the course of our doings, we made porridge. Well, that was a different matter. We put a dixie of water on and ladled some oats in. And as the oats swelled, we had to keep ladling it out and filling it up with water. And we actually had enough porridge for 3 days. In the first, we did the same with the rice pudding. But we ran out of these easy commodities for sweets and that, and all we had left was flour and currants and such like. Well, I thought he'd let them be duff, and I don't know nothing about making duff. But probably having seen Mother years ago, and I broke a few bread loaves up, two or three, and went up to the local shop and got 6 penny worth of baking powder and margarine, and I mixed a big dollop of duff. Then I suddenly realised that these duffs had to have a pudding cloth to boil in, but couldn't find no pudding cloth. So I went around the lads and said, anybody got anything that would make a pudding cloth? The only thing they could come up with, was chappy raked out of his kit, he said, was a pair of cellular drawers. They were brand new, he said, never been used, I could tell that, but so I took them and boiled them up and tied up all the apertures, made a pudding cloth, blocked cellular drawers. But anyway, dished it up the next day, and they were rattling the plates for seconds, and all the plates were clean. I'd made a bucket of custard, and this stuff had really gone down well. I'd enjoyed it. Made it a pair of cellular drawers.
Yeah. Did you see anything of the plight of the Londoners under the bombing?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that was a terrible thing. I don't know. You went down there. Well, you could see them. Anyone that wasn't engaged otherwise got home from work at tea time or thereabouts, grabbed their blankets and off down the undergrounds. They were allowed to go down and sleep on the platforms of the underground stations. And they literally only left a bare path on the edge of the platform for anyone to get on a train. They had the blankets, and they must have slept down there, some of them, for years. And everything went on there. There were young couples, of course, and there were grandfather on one side of them, baby on the other, and what went on under the blanket was they had to keep producing for the future generations, I suppose. I wonder how many people were conceived, living today, were conceived down in those underground stations. But no one took any notice of them, but least of all the copulators under the blanket. But
so how did you come to leave the country then?
Oh, eventually it was my turn, I suppose, and I was put upon draft, and away we went. Did my draft leave and got issued with kit, and of course we only had one battalion abroad, and that was in Egypt, in the desert. There was no other fighting at that time. End of 1942. So eventually we left Regent's Park Barracks at 10 o'clock one night with a corps of drums, and we marched through London up to Addison Street Station, a goods depot, I believe, but nevertheless, there was our train taking us somewhere. Well, you weren't allowed, you had to be very careful what you wrote. Oh, in those days, censor would be scribbling it out. And my mother kept the last letter I ever wrote before I went abroad. And I think the only thing you could read on it in the finish was "Love, Mum," at the finish. And but they needn't have bothered, because here we were. And didn't the Germans know we had only one battalion abroad? And with pith helmets strapped on with backpacks as we marched through London. I mean, even the sparrows would know where we were going. And certainly Lord Haw-Haw did, because he mentioned it on the news and on his news the next night. He said about a detachment of guardsmen were en route for the desert. And but one thing he didn't know, and that was from what port we were leaving. and neither did we. But the next day we ended up at Greenock on the Clyde, and there waiting for us was that beautiful ship, the Queen Mary. Well, we were about the first draft on board, I think, and when she took, I believe it was 15,000 troops, packed in. Well, we were lucky. I was getting into a cabin. They were allocated to you, of course. Cabin normally for two persons, which had been converted to take six. That was quite good, but the swimming pool, that was one hell hole. It had been drained, of course, and they'd built bunks in that 16 high, and you walk between them sideways. And the bloke still had the kit bags, all the junk. And how they lived in there, I don't know whether it was better at the top or the bottom, but they climbed up them like monkeys. And we eventually sailed on the 23rd of December, and she went out across the North Atlantic on her own. She had no escort. She was deemed to be faster than any U-boats, but she went round where they normally found U-boats, and so they went across the North Atlantic. Well, it was rough, in my opinion, so I got out on the promenade deck, and I was hung onto the rail, wondering where the sea had gone to one second, jerking my head back, thinking it was drowning me the next. The waves there were something unbelievable. And a crew member came, or a seaman, and he stood watching. In my ignorance, in the finish, I turned to him, because I had never before been out in the ocean. I said, "Is it rough, pal, or is it always like this, or is it rough?" He looked at me a bit sorrowfully, I thought, for a time, and he turned to go below. As he did so, he said, "Well, I don't think you'll ever see it any rougher, and I hope I never do, because the ship, of course, had these shell doors which cut off the corridors, and it also cut off your access to the latrines and toilets." And I think everyone on board that ship was seasick. Within about 24 hours, if you'd stood in a corridor, the vomit was that thick, it would have filled in on top of your boot toes. Stench was something unbelievable. And I recall after, when we'd got out of this storm, and there was an old seaman, obviously an old hand, and he had a party of soldiers there with squeegees trying to sweep this stuff out of the scuppers, and chafing and grumbling. 40 years at sea, he said, "I've never ever seen anything like this in my life." So I thought my initial sea voyage was a very unfortunate one in one way. Anyway, we sailed across the Atlantic. Where she went, actually, I don't know, but she tic-tacked all the way. Then it worked out that from firing a torpedo so many seconds before it would possibly hit a ship, so she tacked them a few seconds sooner. It was intriguing to see the wake behind her as it zigzagged across the ocean. Well, we first port of call was Sierra Leone. That took us 10 days, so where we'd been around the ocean, I don't know. And we took on oil and water there. And then swung out into the South Seas, and we came up into Cape Town, the next port, for some more water, I think, and oil. And during that time, some senior army officers that wore red flashes on their collars and epaulets, thought they could go anywhere they liked on a ship, they were trespassing up on the officer's deck, which the ship's officers, this is, and it was just behind the bridge, which the ship's officers objected to, and they asked for a sentry to be put on the steps leading up to them. So, of course, junior NCOs of the guards detachment, which I was one of, got this job, and I was fortunate enough to be on the top of these steps. It was a sit-down job, it was okay. Between 2 and 4 o'clock in the morning, when she was heading up into Cape Town Bay, and an officer came off the bridge. "Corporal, come and look at this," he said. "You'll never see a sight like it in your life again." And he took me up on the bridge. And there in front of us was the Bay of Cape Town as the lands rose up from the sea. And Cape Town, a beautiful, clean town, being no industry. And then above that, a sheet of white cloud. And then above that, the top of Table Mountain. A sight, yes, that officer was right. I'd never seen a sight like it. So I thought, I'm rather fortunate in being on the Queen Mary. More fortunate still in being able to say I rode on the bridge and to see that. Of course, not many people would see that travelling normally in peacetime. You see, she wasn't sticking to the normal shipping channels. She would have crept down the west coast of Africa and it's round the corner. Probably got in there when everyone was asleep, no doubt. We then left. The only time she had an escort was we left there and crept round into the Indian Ocean. We had an escort for, I don't know, possibly 48 hours or something like that before she blew off and cleared off. So the possibly a submarine hanging about there somewhere. And then we got up in the Red Sea and of course she couldn't get to the port side. She just anchored in the middle and we drifted ashore in anything the locals had. Drifters and coasters and barges or anything. And we ended up at Ishbaelia, I think they call the place. Ishbaelia or something. But that was a definite British Army transport camp. The bell tents there were as in line as any line of guardsmen ever could be. But that night, there was a sandstorm blew up. Well, no one ever woke me. I think for some reason our tent wasn't never in danger, but it blew half the tents down. I always remember a poor lad, he'd got married on his draft leave. And his wife had presented him with a signet ring. And pulling on the guide ropes at night, he'd lost it. And there he was on his hands and knees next morning looking for it in all this bloody miles of sand. I felt sorry for the lad, but I didn't think he had much chance of finding that ring. We then boarded some trucks, sent over from America. The battalion at that time that we were joining was being given some rest. It was depleted in numbers so badly, and it had been sent up to a Qutana Barracks, which was an army camp north of Syria.
Which battalion was this?
The 3rd Battalion, Coldstream. Yeah. Well, the brigade was up there. They were forming a brigade. 3rd Battalion Coldstream, 2nd Battalion Scots Guards, and the 6th Battalion Grenadiers. We boarded these trucks and set off to join these. Well, that meant crossing the Nile, and there was a pontoon bridge across there. And then across the Sinai Desert, We stayed on the shores of Galilee for some reason for 2 nights. Then we went right round the Jordan Valley and eventually ended up at Qutana Barracks. Well, that was be in January. It would be 26 days, I think, on board the Queen Mary without putting foot ashore. But it was bitter cold. And the only time in my service that I ever knew the British Army issue more than 4 blankets, and they were issuing 6 that night. But for once, I was out of luck. When I got to the quartermaster's stores, he hadn't any more. When I got back to them, there were these elephant hut things. Neither was there any bed boards. So my only option was either walk about all night or kip down on the concrete floor. I kept every bit of clothing on I had, greatcoats and everything, and what blankets I had, and kept on the concrete floor. But next morning, 2 blokes had to lift me up, and eventually galloped me up and down the hut. I was that stiff, I should think possibly another hour or so of that had finished me off, but bah. Anyway, we worked there many days before the order came to rejoin the line. And we boarded these same trucks and driven back the way we'd come. How many hundreds of miles that was. Seemed to be a bit of a waste. But we then did altogether over a 3,000-mile convoy run. That at that time was the largest, longest convoy run the British Army had ever made. But setting off a few days after us from Iraq or Iran or somewhere, the Black Cat Div, they beat us by a few miles. Did a longer run than us. But we drove all day, every day. Sand, sand and more sand. But you got that fed up just sitting there driving, and it's a very slow pace in a convoy at the best of times, and tedious. But anybody drove. And I was with the Sergeant Major, I had a 3-ton truck and the reserve ammunition, of course, with the Sergeant Major in charge. So I was driving the Sergeant Major, and he would take a turn at the wheel. And we got to head in for Saloum. But there was the escarpment before that. How many 100 feet that was, I don't know, but the engineers had chipped a road in. It was like a corkscrew. You wound your way up vertically, like a fly up a wall. And every time you came out there, you could look over. We had no cabs on these trucks. And there was the sea broiling in the rock below you. Well, that day, the hydraulic brakes had gone on my truck. So we got to this, and the Sergeant Major said, "What do you do now?" Oh, I said, "I'm going up." "I'm not going over there with you," he said. And he stood on the running board, which it happened to be, and he rode all the way up there on the running board. I said, "Well, I had no intention of going over there, but I had plotted it out that if the convoy stopped in front of me, I'd, every respect for my engine, I knew it would take me up in bottom gear, provided no one stopped in front." And I thought the only thing to do then is let it slip back with left hand down on the wheel and run the back into the wall of a... hopefully. Anyway, we got up. Got the brakes mended the next day. And the next thing, we went over the top and dropped down a long run down into Derna. Now, this was a fair descent. And the technical adjutant stopped before we went over the brow to do this. He stopped every truck and instructed every driver to engage bottom gear. I wondered what the hell we're heading for. And I didn't tell him that my brakes had gone again. So, what are you doing this time? I said, well, carry on. I saw when we got over the top and started this descent, it was like Elephant's Graveyard down below us in the valley where trucks had turned over, got out of hand and rolled down there. Well, there was one brake drum on the cannon shaft, and I had it tight on until it began to burn the brake drums. And the truck behind came up closer than he should have been, shouted, your truck's on fire. So we got pulled in and doused it with a fire extinguisher. So we go again. And we got down okay. Then, where did we get till then? Oh, we're going up. We had to get off the one road. There was only one road across North Africa. Tarmac Road. And we got onto the sand tracks the last few nights. And the sergeant made you never turn at the wheel, he said. Well, all you had to drive by was a little tiny light which shone on the diff of the lorry in front of you.
The diff?
The differential casing in the middle of the back axle. And there was a little white patch of white paint, and they'd rigged a light to just shine on it. But you only saw that at about 10 yards distant if your eyes were good. But the thing to do if it disappeared and left you was to just carry on casually driving along a nice steady pace. But the sergeant major, he began putting his foot down this night. Now I said, go steady. I said, because that truck in front will come back and eat you any second. I must keep with the company, he said. I said, you'll keep with it if you keep this pace up. We did. We hit the truck in front. It hit the next truck. And it hit the third truck. Well, they were able to carry on, but my radiator was smashed right back into. And so they just pushed me off the road and said, somebody will collect you. And the next morning along came the, what did they call it? LAD wagon, local aid detachment or something or other, I forget. And he'd four trucks on tow behind him. They hooked mine on the back. So we're like a little train going along the desert road. They dumped me in a engineer's workshop and left me. I was there about a week. Quite handy.